Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Previously on The Lawrence Holmes Show.
That's an unpopular opinion, man. People don't want you to talk bad about Sandlot.
What didn't you like about Sandlot?
Okay, you know some of the things I don't like about Sandlot. You know I don't like the idea of how movies almost always get wrong how baseball games or sporting events are broadcast. That bothers me. Is he doing that? Like, he's at the ballpark at the end? Is he the radio guy?
Yes.
Okay. And he's Vin Scully then. So he's just doing the game by himself. He doesn't even have no headphones on.
None.
He looks like he's calling the game from his home. Benny the Jet Rodriguez isn't stealing home in the majors. He barely made it to the majors. Let's be real. Let's be really real. And where'd he get that mustache from? It's awful.
We all know when we played when we were youngsters, the kid who's bad at baseball stays bad at baseball. He doesn't prove the next day and hit a home run eventually. What the hell's happening? Smalls is like, I don't know how to play baseball.
I've never
Tuesday,
played baseball
but
before.
On Friday, because Benny told me to hold my glove right here, I can play baseball now.
And he hit it right there.
Make me a bicycle clown.
Man, did we dump on Sandlot yesterday. After we dumped on Varsity Blues with Hannah Kaiser. Why wasn't your last game, Mox? Aren't the playoffs next week? Welcome in. I'm Lawrence Holmes here with you until 2 o'clock. We got a loaded show today. We're going to talk with Cody Westerlund in just a minute. Darren Jackson, White Sox analyst, is going to be on with us at 12:40. And then at 1:20, Scott Miller of Bleacher Report is going to be on the show. Man, if you haven't read his story about Esteban Loaiza, while I'm doing the show, until he gets on the air at 1:20, just read it. Just read pieces of it while you're listening to the show if you're not driving. Because that Esteban Loaiza story is amazing. And we're going to talk with Scott about how he tracked all of this stuff down and what he thought about it. So we got a lot of stuff that's on the table. I wanted to start with a little bit of, I mean, I guess in the world that we live in now, this is considered breaking news because sports is kind of slowly ramping itself back up. By the way, we're broadcasting live from the Hyundai Score Studios, presented by your local Hyundai dealers. And let me just say this about Hyundai. We really appreciate them, them being the station studio sponsor. So for all the local Hyundai dealers out there, and our friends at Rose and Hyundai for sure, we appreciate you for sticking with us while sports has been down a little bit. The breaking news, and it's a small news item, but news nonetheless, is that since things seem to be going better from a test and mortality rate for the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois, very quietly, the Advocate Center looks like it's reopened up. So I wanted to talk with my guy, Cody Westerlund, who joins me now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from, alpamonteford.com. Cody, how are you, man?
I'm doing well. How are you, Lawrence?
I'm doing all right. I wanted to know what you thought about the guys on the Bulls getting back to work a little bit in individual workouts.
Yeah, so the Bulls are on track for that to start next Wednesday. There was some discussion about whether they could do it today under the Illinois State guidelines. But as we know here in Chicago, the city and Lori Lightfoot are moving toward phase three reopening next Wednesday. So that looks like when players will be allowed for voluntary workouts at the Advocate Center. That's when essential personnel can get into the Advocate Center as well, which means a few more bodies in there for the Bulls to get some on-court workouts and help the players out. Obviously, at this time, most of the guys have been out of the market since March when the NBA allowed players to go back home or wherever they wanted to go to be with family members and such. So they'll have a few days to get into town. They don't have to go. I don't expect it to be 15 people in there on Wednesday probably because there's so many moving parts here, but it's a good first step. A lot of NBA teams have already opened their facilities. I believe 23 or 24 have done so. Obviously, with the coronavirus outbreak in Chicago, Illinois has been a little farther behind the timeline, so the Bulls will now be one of the final teams to get into their facilities again next week, it looks like.
Okay, great. Well, that's good. They'll have an opportunity to get back. Now there are the bigger issues that I wanted to get to with you when it comes to the NBA and the Bulls in particular. From what you've seen, read, and talked to people about their plan of opening up, what do you think about it?
Well, I think it's good that everyone's getting back in their gyms, but it's still the million-dollar question of how the season's going to play out, basically. And the NBA zeroed in on Walt Disney World in Orlando to resume the season in some format. And right now, all we know that the NBA is tracking toward that, and they're trying to decide how many teams will be invited back. So it leaves teams like the Bulls up in the air a little bit here because they could be back in the gymnasium, teams at the bottom of standings as well, and still not know if they're going to play another game for the rest of the season. And all indications are that it won't be all 30 teams. It does not make sense to bring all 30 teams back for games because that's the highest risk for spreading the coronavirus. So any team, any group that you keep out that goes beyond the 15 players on a roster and the coaching staff, you got so many team staff, there's medical personnel in the traveling party and such. That adds up quickly. So it looks like the NBA is going to bring back 16, 20, or 24 teams are the three most likely formats for them to do that. The Bulls would not be invited back if it's 16 teams, if it's 20 teams. Seeing as they are in the top 12 in the East, they could come back if the NBA decided to move forward with some sort of 24-team structure, playoff format, finish a few regular season games or have a play-in tournament. That could be in play, but there's Board of Governors meeting scheduled today for the NBA where there should be a little bit more clarity, and then hopefully they'll know next week how they want to return to play.
From what you've been able to figure out, Cody, is there any credence to the idea that the NBA needs to get to that 70-game threshold for their regional sports networks?
Yeah, that's been bandied about. I think more than anything, they just want to play more than 16 teams come back and go directly to the playoffs. They want more games beyond that. So I don't know that it has to be a 70-game threshold on the regular season schedule for teams to come back. I think that's why they're kicking around the World Cup-style bracket format where they would have four groups of five teams or four groups of six teams and have a pool play round, and teams would play 8 or 10 games in their pool play and then move on to the final eight because that's more games than just a first-round series traditionally. That's more games than if you just finish, you know, 4 or 5 games for a regular season. But I understand that coming from a local TV perspective, but the other part you got to realize here is that there's different agendas for every NBA owner. The Lakers get a lot of money from their local TV contract because it's outrageously big and they're a big market and one of the historic teams, heritage teams kind of in the NBA. Now, the Charlotte Hornets probably don't care about their local TV contract as much because they don't get as much money out of it, and they would be operating not breaking even in doing so because you got to remember here is a key fact. NBA teams pay their players for regular season games, but players earn money in the playoffs based on the TV national television revenue bonus structure, really. So anything that's framed in the playoff context, that money is coming out of a pool of playoff money that players get. If you go back and were to say these are regular season games, we're getting to so many games for everyone, that money traditionally comes out of teams' pockets. They pay players for the regular season games. So how they brand it is important, and that will be in the CBA discussions as well moving forward in the return to play negotiations with the financial aspects. But it is something to keep an eye on.
What are the concerns that the players have?
Well, safety certainly is number one. I don't think any of these players want to go back for a few games if they're going to risk themselves or their family members in any way. And it doesn't sound like the NBA wants family members to be at Orlando initially. They understand that teams that play for several weeks or a couple months here at some point need to see their family. But it seems like they would most likely keep them away for the first week or two as they kind of assimilate with their plans and get everything set up. But safety, number two, also would be players coming back. And beyond just their safety and the coronavirus aspect, like, why go back if there's not meaningful basketball to play for and risk an ACL tear or something serious? There's also guys that are set to become free agents this offseason. And as much uncertainty as there is with the financial landscape because of the declining revenue and everything, there's guys that had really good seasons. And if they're on a non-playoff team, like, what's the point? I mean, really, for anyone that's not having a chance to win the championship, what's the point of going out there and risking your health if you're a free agent, or even if you're not a free agent and just, you know, had a good year, it's over, we don't have anything to play for. So the concerns are health, the concerns being away from family for a long time for the teams that are contending for a championship. And it's just, if there's not anything to play for, why go back out there? Damian Lillard expressed that the other day. If the Blazers don't have a chance in the play-in tournament and he's just going to go out there to finish some regular season games, he's probably just going to sit on the bench in a suit and watch. He's not going to go out there and lace them up. So I understand that, but those are the primary concerns for players.
Cody Westerlund covers the Bulls for us here at The Score, does a great job of writing for 670thescore.com. How would you suggest that the NBA tackle the draft lottery?
Oh, that's a $1 million question for these bad teams. I think it would be disingenuous in many ways for a team like the Bulls. Let's use them as the example because they're on the fringe here. Is it really fair for the Bulls to go out and play in a play-in tournament and you're saying we need your best effort, but if you do play well for a few days and move into the final 16 teams to steal the 8th seed in the East or something like that, and then get eliminated in three games in a best-of-five first-round series, why should your draft lottery standing move back so much? Because you got to remember, the Bulls are lined up 7th right now. If you were to get in the final 16 teams, if they had 24 and you get down to 16, traditionally those 16 final teams are outside of the lottery, so your pick would move back to 15th at best. So I would think that the NBA shouldn't have teams like the Bulls playing for a playoff spot to get eliminated quickly and then lose their draft lottery standing. So I would weight it heavily somehow on the current standings. Now, the teams on the fringe, you look at like the Kings, the Spurs, the Blazers, are still trying to track down the Grizzlies for the 8th seed in the West, and we're going to be on the back end of the lottery. They're not moving back as far. So for the draft lottery, I think that's more incentive the more I think this out, is to not invite more than 20 teams. Because a team like the Bulls, really, as much as Jim Boylan wants to go out there and coach them, as much as the new front office wants to see the Bulls play basketball and get a read on some of their players here for a few games if they could, they do not want to risk going falling back from the 7th best chance in the lottery to the 15th best chance. That just does them no good long term. Even if they were to move into the Eastern Conference semifinals or among the final 8 teams in the NBA, it does not help their long-term trajectory after they went 22-43 in this season so far. So I think the NBA personally should somehow freeze the lottery standings and percentages for the 10 worst teams or so, and then dole them out a little bit more based on a play-in tournament if you have 20 teams or so.
You read my mind about where I wanted to go next on this, Cody. Is what do the Bulls have to gain? Is there – because I was trying to work through this on my podcast last night, and I came to the conclusion of, yeah, I'd kind of like to see the Bulls resume, even if it is 3 games or 5 games or how many games they would end up playing, I'd be okay with that. Is there anything that you think there's value in them trying to play some games?
I see very little value. I think the one thing they could get out of it is for the new front office is just seeing these young players play with each other presumably healthy now. Lauri Markkanen had just come back from a pelvic injury and has still been getting treatment on everything. Otto Porter Jr. had just returned. But right now they're doing everything off film as they evaluate these players. I think there is something to learn in seeing them just in person playing and when you can talk to them on a daily basis. So I see some value in that, but that value by no means outweighs the value of moving, falling back in the draft lottery. I don't even think it outweighs the health risk that you could take from a coronavirus standpoint. I don't think it outweighs the health risk you could take for blowing out a knee or something like that. So I do understand why they'd want to see these guys play. I just don't think there's too much value in it altogether. And I'm sure they want to see Jim Boylan coach. I mean, from a PR perspective, the best thing they can do is let him coach out a few games and saying we gave the most fair shot and everything. But by all indications, their decision is their mind's about made up on Jim Boylan's future, according to Joe Calley of the Sun-Times. So I don't see a lot of good coming for the Bulls in that regard.
If I put you in charge of this restart, would you take the teams that are closest to the eighth seed in the West and add them without adding the teams from the East, or would you try to make it balanced?
I would not make it balanced. I would kind of use the commissioner's power, if you want to call it that, and I would say I want good basketball. I want to see the best young stars. I want to see teams that have earned it here at the end. And I don't care that the Wizards and Hornets are slightly on the outside of the Eastern Conference playoff picture. You guys have stunk at basketball this year. I think everyone understands we want Zion Williamson to play meaningful games. Let's get the Pelicans into some sort of play-in scenario. So I would invite the Pelicans. I would invite the Blazers. Let Damian Lillard go out there. Like, those are stars. I understand it's kind of hollow in some ways. It's not the most fair thing, but everyone wants to see good basketball. They want to see young stars. I think everyone understands that this is a difficult, unique circumstance, so I think you can get away with it. I think if the NBA ever is going to experiment with playoff structure changes and stuff like that, this is the perfect time to do it if you get clearance from the health professionals. If the doctors say, look, the risk is 40% more if you invite 20 teams instead of 16, if there's an exponential factor, which there probably is, based off doctors' guidance and everything. Like, if they say no, I would lean toward the health, safety, and everything. But if they say, hey, it's okay to bring 20 teams, I would bring 4 extra teams from the Western Conference and let them in some format play into it, because I think it would be really fun to watch Zion and Damian Lillard play for the final playoff spot. Maybe give the Grizzlies a little bit of advantage where they only have to win one game, and Zion and the Blazers have to win 2 or 3 in some format where they win one day, keep playing the next, move on down the line based on seeding. Would seem a little bit more fair. But I think you need to look at this as an opportunity to experiment a little bit, given the circumstances of everything.
What do you suspect that next season looks like, and when does it start?
Christmas, probably. That would be my best guess. That makes a lot of sense from a television standpoint. You stay away from the NFL. There's no way this year gets done by mid-September, probably at the earliest now. Could even take longer. You have to give these guys a couple months off. You just have to, especially these teams that are going to be playing for the championship. Look, they're going to be really going really hard at the end. They're going to be playing a lot of games in a short time frame too. Many situations they could be playing every other day. You don't only do that in the playoffs. A lot of times you get 2 days off between games. You could have 4 days off between series if you wrap one up early and everything. So they're going to be going hard at the end. You got to get these guys some rest in the offseason, even though half the league or a third of the league might have like 8 or 9 months off. These best teams aren't going to have that luxury in that sense. So everything makes sense for it to start next year at Christmas. 82 games is really important for the owners, not just for television revenue, but also the longer the season goes, the more games you play, the farther you get down the line in the coronavirus pandemic, the higher likelihood you can put fans in the stands, more of them if you don't fill up your arena. So I could see the NBA just going back to the 82-game schedule next year, starting on Christmas, and the time frame being a couple years behind. Now, you gotta squeeze the games together a little bit more or trim down from 82 if you want to get back to the classic start in October schedule. But I think once this happens, they're going to realize not facing the NFL for two 2 months of your season, a month and a half of your season, is really important, and that you can kind of own and dominate the calendar a little bit more. You got to remember, too, the NBA is going to go to a calendar where they finish in August or something sometime. That's kind of the dead days for baseball, too. So, like, right after the All-Star break in baseball is when people are kind of like, man, the season's really long. It's a slog. The NBA could be having its Western Conference, Eastern Conference finals at that point in time, and the NBA finals after that. So I think there's a lot of merit in pushing the NBA calendar back for these guys from a revenue perspective down the line.
Last thing I got for you, Cody. Obviously, we are in a really bizarre window, and trying to figure out what the Bulls do in the offseason is weird because we don't know when that offseason starts. If everything's normal, how would you hope that Arturis Karnišovas and Mark Eversley go about this next phase of Bulls basketball and taking step one?
Well, I think when the NBA has a resolution to the format for the rest of the season, the Bulls find out if they're playing or not. And if they're not playing, everyone sit down in a big room, get together 6 feet apart, anyone that's essential and can get in there, get back on the Zoom call with everyone you need to, and decide on Jim Boylan's future. And I think you need that quickly, because if you're going to get a new coach and move on, and it makes all the sense in the world for a new regime to have a new coach, you need to get going and then start an open nationwide search, not one of those Gar Forman, John Paxson nationwide searches where they just drive to Ames, Iowa. But you go out there and you put out a full cast of net wide, have a lot of interviews, and see who you like and hire a new coach and get on with it. And then you're on the same page from there. I mean, the draft and free agency are going to be pushed back quite a bit here to the fall sometime, probably not till October or so if the season ends in mid or late September. So you have a lot of time to assess your personnel there as the NBA carry on the playoffs if you're not involved. But then you gotta see what you can do. They don't have a lot of cap space this summer, obviously, or whenever free agency is in the fall, because Otto Porter Jr. is obviously going to opt into his $28 million by all indications. So you got to see what you can do at the margins and plan ahead. So I think just getting your coaching staff figured out is the biggest thing. And then from there, you decide what you can do this summer and what you have to kick down the line when you have more cap space. But evaluate these guys and understand who's a part of your future from the young guy's perspective and who's not part of your future. You need to get as much value as you can out of them on the trade market. So that's what they need to decide internally.
Cody, thanks so much for being on the show. Great analysis as per usual, and keep up the great work.
Appreciate it. Have a good rest of the day.
That's Cody Westerlund. He covers the Bulls for us here at The Score. You can check him out at 670thescore.com. Cody in there is talking a little bit about how you could have a change in the way stadiums operate, like as far as capacity goes. I had a really interesting conversation with a reporter who covers college sports, and what she told me about the architecture of sports stadiums and how it's already starting to change is good stuff that I think you need to hear. We'll do that next here on The Score.
Molly
and Haw here.
A lot of us aren't driving to work right now.
That means no car radio, but you still can start your day with us from the comfort of your home. Listen on your radio, your laptop, your mobile device through the radio.com app, or tell your smart speaker to play 670 The Score.
You can always count on us for the latest Chicago sports stories. We're live, local, and we're keeping Chicago connected.
Molly and Haw, mornings 5 to 9 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com.
Chicago Sports Station.
Brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2. On Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Coming up in less than 10 minutes, Darren Jackson's going to join me. I'm excited to talk with Darren because I love hearing Ed Farmer stories, and I don't know if anyone has more Ed Farmer stories than Darren Jackson does. So we're going to talk with him coming up in a little bit. At 1:20, we're going to talk with Scott Miller of Bleacher Report. He wrote a piece about Esteban Loaiza that is out of this world, and I want to ask him about the reporting on it. I want to ask him about how Loaiza's life took such a horrible turn. He finds himself in prison for drug smuggling. Like, we'll get into that at 1:20. In the last segment, Cody Westerlund was talking about how we could see some changes in the way that we, if once we get to a point where we can go back to games, if we get back to that point, that we could see a change in the way that stadiums are configured for NBA. Earlier this week, I talked with Christy Dosh, who's extremely impressive in discussing college football in particular, but college sports overall. And she does a great job writing for Forbes about the subject and the money of it. She said some things that I was like, wow, like I did not realize that that was happening. When it comes to the way that college football is approaching how differently things could look if they try to get fans back into stands.
College football, I think, is complicated in a number of different ways. It's important to not only get them back playing, but from a financial perspective, it's really important to get fans in the stadium. And at the beginning of this, I thought there's no way there will be any fans in the stands. They will figure out how to play the game on the field, but there's no chance there's going to be fans. And now I wake up every morning to a new plan from another school that's going to allow 15,000 fans or 20,000 or 30,000 or 50,000. You know, they're all trying to figure out what they can put in place. And I've been talking to architects and engineers who say their phones have been blowing up because they want to do all of these sort of temporary changes to stadiums to block areas off, you know, to separate fans and groups from each other, because financially they're very dependent on actually having fans in the stands. I think that complicates it. And then having conferences that play across so many different states, not being able to do what, you know, Major League Baseball and the NBA and the NHL have talked about, where you're restricted to, you know, two or three or four cities. College football is all across America, and most of the bigger conferences are across, you know, half a dozen or more states. And so I think that complicates matters as well.
The going into the stadium tickets is where college football makes a lot of its money. So you're starting to get a little bit of outside the box thinking. When Christy said this, I was like, okay, I'm interested. I want to learn more. So how are they going to design these makeshift temporary, and use air quotes with that, temporary stadium ideas to get fans back into the stands?
A lot of it has had to do with design aspects in terms of turning more areas into sort of club-like spaces. You know, there have been several stadiums and basketball arenas over the years that have done these sort of pods of seats that are premium level seats. I know Louisville's basketball arena has an example of this. Is the first one I think of off the top of my head, because we know people are going to come in groups. They're going to come as a couple or maybe a family of four. You know, they're going to come in some sort of group they feel comfortable with. It's not like most people are coming to the game solo. So you want to allow for groups of say four or six or eight to be able to sit together, but you don't want the next group right next to them. You want some spacing between groups. So I think there's going to be some creative design that maybe is going to allow us to have more premium sort of seating areas, or areas that at least feel premium, versus some of the, you know, more sort of clustered on top of each other kind of stands. Now, some people love that. People love sitting in the bleachers, or they love being in the student section or whatever, but I think we're going to see more of those sort of grouped off premium areas.
Yeah, and if there's going to be grouped off premium areas, and then you're going to create demand for the tickets, kind of feels like this is an opportunity to get the unwashed out of going to games. We'll see how it plays out, but it's one of the things that crossed my mind was, oh, so you take a place that's capacity was 100,000, you turn that capacity down to 25,000, you section it off, and because the tickets will be so scarce, you could really charge a big ticket and maybe make some of your revenue back that way. But there'll be a group of people who won't be able to go if things go badly. And sometimes in capitalism, that is the case. I'm going to talk with Darren Jackson about his friend Ed Farmer next here on The Score.
This is 670 The Score. We're your home for live, local Chicago sports. Homegrown Chicago guys talking about all of Chicago's teams. We are live and local. Sports Radio 670 The Score. Chicago's number one sports station. Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Sometimes you hear that music, you know the day, you just want to sing Cinco de Mayo. You know.
Is the song of Cinco de Mayo?
Cinco de Mayo. Yeah, you know that one.
Yeah, we all know that one. That's a great song. And I'm glad that does he get royalties? Does Darren get royalties for us playing it? I hope so, because that's an original song that he made up. So happy to have Darren Jackson on the show here on The Score. He joins me now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 5G new and used vehicles for you to choose from. You can go check it out at alpamonteford.com. White Sox color analyst Darren DJ Jackson joining me here on The Score. DJ, how are you, man?
Lawrence, I'm doing well, my friend. Thank you for asking. How you been?
I'm hanging in there. You know, it's been a very interesting and weird and sometimes saddening few months, but I'm doing the best that I can, just like everybody else. And I wanted to ask you about it, because in the middle of all of this that's been going on with us being in our homes and there being a pandemic going on, we lost one of our friends, and Ed Farmer. And I don't know if anyone was as close to him outside of his family as you were. And I know that you took a lot of time to try and figure out how you felt about this, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate you jumping on and talking with me about it now, because I'm sure it doesn't sting any less than it did on April 1st. But what are the things that you've taken away from being partnered up and being friends with Ed Farmer?
You know what, Lawrence? I think just like you and so many other people that spent time with Ed, I think the memories that he just created with each individual. I mean, he just had a different relationship with everybody that he came across. And with me, he and I were like brothers. Some people would say we were like an old married couple up there in the booth, but we had a little act. We'd have a little fun. We'd pick on each other. We did our things. We'd get together with people, and you knew better, but we'd get together with people, and they said, "Do you guys even like each other?" And then they'd spend time with us, and they go, "Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me? These guys are best friends." But yeah, the association with Ed and me, you know, it's so memorable. There's no way that I haven't had a day that I haven't thought about something interesting, funny, or angering about Ed that we did together. And it'd be just little things. So let's give you a story. Ed and I are walking down the street from having lunch one day in Toronto. And next thing you know, he's walking at a good clip. I'm walking with him, and somebody passed us walking. He goes, "Oh, I don't think so." And off. He starts racing the person down the street in a speed walk contest that the person didn't even know he was in. And I got back to the hotel. He was waiting in the lobby. I go, "What's wrong with you?" And he just said, "I won." I just said, "That's it." I said, "You got to let the other people know they're in the race too, Ed. It's not just you." So this was day in and day out kind of things that happened, spending time with Ed, and it'll never be forgotten.
I love what you were saying about how if people aren't used to it, they're like, "Wow, do those two guys like each other?" And I actually think that it plays on the radio like that too, where people are listening to you guys, and if they just catch like 20 seconds of it, like, "Do these guys like each other?" But if they listen for a minute, you go, "Oh my God, they're like best friends, and it's disgusting how much they love each other."
Well, that's it. And you know what? It's just so many different things. I can think of the times where Ed just would meet people anywhere we were, whether it be standing on a street corner, walking down the street, on a BART in San Francisco, anywhere. He created new fan bases for the White Sox. He'd see somebody with an Oakland A's hat. Next thing you know, it's, "Oh, I played for the A's. I'm with the White Sox now. The A's stink." Next thing you know, he's converted them. He's got them in our booth when they're at a game in Oakland. I'm like going, "How about this guy?" I mean, he created so many White Sox fans across this nation. If they already had their favorite team, at least their second favorite team was always going to be the Sox, and that's Ed Farmer to a T.
How is he able to do that thing that Ed does, where he kind of knows everybody? And I don't know if I've ever met someone like him who, no matter what you mention, no matter what city you go to, he legitimately has friends that are going to be invited up to the booth or a memory attached to it. How did he do that?
Well, this is it. I mean, through so many different variations of this guy, he'd be in a lobby and he'd see somebody and he'd just start talking to him. Or literally we could go out to a driving range on a road trip and he'd see somebody and start talking to him. This guy knows somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody. And that was his whole world of just saying hello and talking to people, making friends, inviting them into his world, which opened up a world for him through these people. It was just a web that never ended. it was something that was pretty impressive, but at the same time, exhausting to be around, because I'd look at him and go, man, I can't keep up with you. I can't do what you do all day. You're going, you're meeting people, you're talking to people, and it was sincere. It wasn't as if he was just doing it to create a web of friends that he can have some kind of connection to get what he wanted. That wasn't it. It was more he was doing something for them, and if it opened a door that was going to allow others to enjoy it as well, fine, because he would get a door open at a car dealership. He didn't want the car, but next thing you know, somebody's calling him saying, hey, you know anybody that knows where I can get a car? He goes, oh, I just met this guy. I put you in touch with him. Those are the things he did.
What's the most random connection that you saw play out while you and Ed were partnered up?
The most random would be there was a time in New York where Ed had this old 308 GTS Ferrari. And somehow he decided when we went out to New York that he was going to go meet this Ferrari guy, this guy that owned a Ferrari dealership across the state line in Jersey. And next thing you know, we're over at a Ferrari dealership. Nino is sitting there saying, yeah, come on, you want to take this Ferrari for a drive, Ed? He just met the guy. It just went by us showing up. And I'm going, okay, wait a minute. Are we really just at a Ferrari dealership? Ed's talking to the guy. They're driving around. And next thing you know, the guy's in our booth, giving us Ferrari memorabilia, shirts, hats, all this. We meet his wife, his kids. They become like family. And I'm like going, I don't know how I'm sitting here knowing a guy in New Jersey that owns a Ferrari place that's giving him a Ferrari stuff. And I'm just sitting there going, okay, I've got a new friend. I mean, that's the kind of random stuff where I just go in. Ed would talk me into going and spending time with people like that. But it was endless. It just kept going on day in and day out, anywhere we were, where he wanted to go do something. And I would just say, fine, I'll keep you company. But by doing that, it kind of changed my world and opened up some doors that I never would have done without him.
White Sox color analyst Darren Jackson joining me here on The Score. What do you think Ed's impact on broadcast was for White Sox fans?
Well, I think what he imparted mostly was the fact that he was a true Chicagoan. Anybody and everybody that listened to a broadcast from Ed Farmer knew where his roots lied. It lied on the south side of Chicago. It lied with the White Sox. It lied with playing for the White Sox, working for the White Sox, for being a good friend of the chairman, Jerry Reinsdorf. All these things, I think everybody really could take away that Ed Farmer was truly bleeding, you know, White Sox black. I mean, it just the way he was, you could not know anything more than the fact he was as loyal as they came to his organization and to his city. So I think for Ed, if anything he's ever going to be remembered, is that he is a true Chicagoan and nothing else.
I love that he would give you room and also that you both would follow up. Like if I'm listening to a broadcast and you explain what happened on a play, Ed can give you an experience that he had, or he'll ask you, well, hey, DJ, when have you been in a situation like that? That type of courtesy from the play-by-play guy, I think, is really important in forging a relationship that's good for the listener.
Well, you're right. You know, he and I went back and forth having our fun with the pitcher angle and the batter angle and the defender angle, all that stuff. And we had fun with that. But you're right. Once we really got into a good game, a good broadcast, Ed was great at making sure he gave you the game accurately and exciting fashion, but he made sure that I was keyed up to go ahead and break down what had just happened. That was his most important thing up in the booth, was to always try and tee me up and make sure that I was set in a position to where I can excel at what I could do as a broadcaster. So Ed Farmer, to me, working with him, not only were we best friends and we had so much fun, it was also educational and very generous of what he would always do with me up in the booth.
Would he ever let you like off the hook as far as like you guys are traveling together? Were there ever days where you were like, you know what, Ed, I can't go on the ride today. I'm just going to have dinner and read my notes and get ready for the game. Or did you always go on the ride?
No, there's no way. Lawrence, I couldn't keep up with him. I'd look at him and I'd say that, man, I cannot keep up with you. You're on your own. I couldn't do it. We'd get up, we'd work out if we were on a road trip in the gym, and I was usually in there before him. I'd see him walking in before I'd leave, and then next thing you know, we're having breakfast. Then he's saying, okay, today, later, we got the off day on the road. We're going to go do this. I go, no, no, you're on your own, my friend. You're going down to see the play off Broadway. You're going to see your friends today. I am taking it easy. I'm taking a walk through the city. And I had to do that multiple times because literally, physically and mentally, I could not keep up with him. It just, I don't know anybody that really could. And most people that spent day in and day out with Ed realize there's no way they could do it for a day. They could do it for a couple of days, but you just couldn't do it every day. It was too exhausting.
DJ, do you think we're going to have baseball this season?
Man, that's like me trying to pick a World Series winner nowadays. I don't even think about that anymore. There's been so many random teams that have won World Series out of nowhere that I would have never thought. Trying to predict if we're actually going to play this year, I feel the same way. There's just no way at any moment can I say, yes, we're going to play, no, we're not going to play. And I've made sure to just stay back and let the people that are in touch with MLB and the people that are in touch with the negotiations contact me and tell me what's happening. Because from there, I don't want to even speculate. I don't even want to try and think if we're going to. Obviously, we're coming to a date where we have to kind of figure out, is it officially done? Or we're going to make this work, but it's really closing in on us, as you well know.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what I was doing before you came on? I was looking at some statistics. I was looking specifically at the 1994 season of one Darren Jackson. And let me tell you, that guy right there was an 817 OPS player. He is 2.7 WAR that season before things broke bad.
That was a transitioning season for me. Let me say that. I went from one type of offensive player to a different one because I got to work with Walt Reniac and Robin Ventura, Ozzie Guillen, Frank Thomas, all these players that kept me on a track that was put in front of me. They said, this is the way we're going to go. This is the approach we're going to have. And every day they made me focus on being a better hitter than just a certain type of hitter, of Deadpool hitter that I was prior to that, and they made me better. And I was able to carry that on for the few years that I played after that. I was able to continue to be a much better productive hitter using the whole field. So that guy in 94 learned right in the middle of his major league career how to become a better hitter, and that's always proven to me. When people are a certain type of player, they keep hitting into the shift, they do this, and they don't want to make adjustments, it drives me crazy because I'm a guy that went from being a Deadpool hitter almost 6 years into the major leagues to using the whole field in one spring training. So nobody's going to tell me it can't be done because I was nobody special to learning how, because somebody helped me, how to become a better player. So when I see guys so stubborn and unable to make the adjustments that are needed, there's ways to get it done. As long as the communication's the right way and you receive it, you can get better as a player. And that's what happened with me in 94.
I felt like that team could have won the World Series. Do you guys feel like you guys could have won the World Series?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, we can sit there and throw darts at the board all day long and say, yeah, we could have been this or that. But my comparison is this. I spent several months with the Toronto Blue Jays in 1993 and how that team was built and how good this team was going on to win a World Series against the Phillies in 93. Well, when I got to the White Sox in 94, I saw the same similarities, strengths, and I realized probably a better pitching staff the White Sox had than the Blue Jays started out. But, man, I looked at that and I go, well, this team is as good, if not better, than the Blue Jays were in 93. I don't see why this team could not win at all. And then come around August, there's no more baseball and that's that. The dream ended, but I do know that team to me was every bit as good, if not better, than the Blue Jays of 93.
DJ, we've just come off this documentary on Jordan, The Last Dance, and they spent a lot of time talking about him playing baseball. What do you remember from all of that?
You know, it was my first year coming to the White Sox. So I was coming in on a non-roster invite from Ron Shuler as a general manager. He said, hey, all you got to do is prove you're healthy, because I had health issues in 93. He said, prove you're healthy and you'll make the team. That's not an issue. So I came to spring training, standing out there in the outfield day in and day out with Michael Jordan, who was trying to learn how to play baseball at a high level. And he hadn't played since high school. And I sat out there day in and day out in right field with Michael talking baseball, trying to show him little tiny things, how to throw the ball into the base the right way, lead with this, do that, field the ball out in front, do these little things. Didn't talk to him about hitting much because he had enough going on. He put the work in with his hitting to be the best that he could be. But anything that had to do with working in the outfield, he and I spent a lot of time out there, and I enjoyed the time. Now, I think the most impressive thing about Michael in that time that I saw is his dedication and hard work, because obviously you know he's a great basketball player. Is he coming in here as a sideshow just to say, hey, I want to play baseball? No, this is a guy that came in actually thinking, I want to be a Major League Baseball player, and I'll do everything and anything it takes to get there. He put more work in than anybody that showed up in spring training in 94. Obviously, he had to. He hadn't played baseball. But that's only because he really made that an attempt to try and play professional baseball. It wasn't a sideshow. He wanted to play. And I was so impressed. This was one thing that impressed me the most. When he got into a game and he put a bat on a ball from a Major League Baseball pitcher, I sat there and go, I can't believe this guy's actually making contact with a Major League pitcher. That blew me away more than anything. And to this day, still one of the greatest things, if you think about it, Michael Jordan hitting a curveball from a Roy Halladay or anybody else, and you're sitting there saying, how could he have done that? This guy should have been in the dirt, scared to death that he was going to get hit in the face with the baseball. Not the case. It tells you about his tenacity and hard work and his true athleticism. So I enjoyed the time. And if I ever bump into Michael, which I haven't seen him in years, you know, I gladly sit there and smile and say, hey, I remember those days of us out there in the outfield, and I'm sure he would as well.
Weren't you the run that scored in the crosstown on his double?
Yes, I was. I was glad he got to do that for the city of Chicago, for Michael. I mean, obviously it's good marketing, good PR work to bring him up there, but I was so happy that he got to play baseball in Major League Stadium. And you know what? The city of Chicago appreciated it, and it's given us a story right now to talk about. So more power to Michael.
DJ, I appreciate the time, and thank you so much for sharing the stories about Ed and making a point to get back with us, because you're a man of your word. So I appreciate you jumping on and telling great stories about our friend.
Yeah, you know it. I appreciate the time, Lawrence, and our friendship we've had over the years. So, you know, I'm here for you. And thank you for kind of understanding that right after the whole thing, that I just needed to step back a little bit. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I hope that I'm hearing you call baseball soon. That would make me very happy.
I hope so. We all need to get back and have our summer sport back. So fingers crossed.
Yes. And this could be a really good year for the White Sox. So a big thanks to Darren Jackson for being on the show. And I'm so glad we got to talk to him, and he got the Ferrari story. I hadn't heard that one. That's a new one on me. Herbie, make sure that we have that forever. Back after this on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.